Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are positively into segment number two with author Justin Fenton from the Baltimore Sun. We Own This City is the book. Of course, shout out to all of our sponsors, including Royal Farms and our friends at Wise Markets as well. And Fade Lees and Costas and a State Fair, where we're going to be doing crab cakes and more crab cakes all summer. You know, I put the murky scene behind me out on the video because this is the murky tale. Justin, I could ask you about your Anne Arundel County background, the Diamondback. We've already talked Dick Irwin and Baltimore Sun, but you're the grizzled, you know, reporter and the veteran reporter and whatever. And this thing, Freddie Gray happens, 15. I remember seeing the fire on both sides out the window to the north of here. I have awful footage of the fire on the east side. And, you know, things changed. Everything changed in the city in so many ways. Our society has changed. I mean, hell, that pre-Trump, right? I mean, Obama was president then. So take me from there and into your story and when this thing becomes a book to you.
Yeah. I mean, the cumulative effect of all this stuff over the years, yeah, it cried out for this, really. I mean, it's hard to tell this story in a newspaper. You know, our articles have to be a certain length. Even if you get a series, it's hard to get to cover all this ground. And as I started mapping things out, I actually made like a master timeline where I synced up things that happened in Freddie Gray, things that happened with the civil rights investigation, things that happened with the Gun Trace Task Force, and how they all sort of overlapped and happened maybe sometimes on the same day. It was really interesting to see that. I also, you know, wanted to show just how much the ground has shifted in a short period of time. The 2010 and 2014 state's attorney's races here were fought on who would be more supportive of police, who was going to bring crime down, who could get the FOP's endorsement. And in 2014, 2015, the Black Lives Matter movement starts. And every month in every city, there is a viral video of something awful happening, some shooting or beating, people, you know, black people dying in interactions with police. And you had marches and protests and calls for reform. And then that was supposed to be happening in Baltimore. We had the Civil Rights Department, the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department come in and do an investigation. And they issued a scathing report. And, you know, we were on our way to a consent decree. And then lo and behold, all this is going on. So, you know, I wanted to put all this together into its broader context and show how the city's crime strategies have shifted, how it's dealt with or not dealt with misconduct, and how all these things sort of came together in this unbelievable, you know, story.
Well, let's talk about, and we will, as part of discussing this, get to Nestor's point about the day they were arrested. And that sort of is almost the end of the story, but then there's some things that happen after that. But
it's still going on in many ways.
still going on in many ways, right. There's just an article recently, right, about Jenkins wanting to start a consulting firm. That was a head scratcher to me. But tell folks, and let me tell you, and I don't know, I don't know what bias this points at in me. It wasn't until your book that I realized that Wayne Jenkins was a white county boy who attended Eastern Technical High School. I read that and I thought, I don't know that I ever knew that. I don't know that I assumed, because so many of the police officers in the city are African American, that Jenkins was an African American. I knew some of the others were, but I thought that the mastermind of this outfit was a kid who grew up in Middle River, who went to Eastern Tech, and he's now got this crime syndicate. Tell all the time and study you've put in to Wayne Jenkins, Justin, who is he?
He's a man. You know, I decided to focus the book on him because he didn't just plead guilty to the worst offenses here. The department really saw him as one of their best. And for years, his colleagues saw him as one of the best. And that's an interesting case study. I mean, you know, you could argue that, you know, he could have been, you know, all the good he could have done for the city, you know, had he stayed on the right path. But that's not what happened. He's serving 25 years in federal prison now. But I wanted to chart, like, you know, who is he? Where does he come from? You know, what kinds of questions were raised along the way. This is a guy who served in the Marine Corps. He was a boxer. I heard different things about him either being a bully growing up or maybe actually standing up to bullies. And then he joins the police department. And, you know, a lot of these plainclothes units are populated by, frankly, as you said, white guys from outside the city, from Pennsylvania, from the counties who, and it's a thrill seeking thing. Ex-military, the city, a lot of city officers will tell you they work in the city, not for the pay, not for the working conditions, but because it's exhilarating. And, you know, that attracts a certain type of person. And that can be used for good and that can be used for bad.
You know, you mentioned, you referenced a former Baltimore County police commissioner, good friend Jim Johnson, in the book. And back to when Jim worked the East Side and he had arrested, I don't know if it was Jenkins or what, or Strep.
Step.
Well, we'll get to Step because Step's one of the fascinating characters. One of the things I did as I read your book, I listed just characters, you know, and Step and Double D Bail Bonds is clearly front and center. But I always remember Nestor has heard me quote former Commissioner Johnson before, and I'm reminded of it when you speak there. He said to me, Don, if we had a magic wand where we could identify when we were recruiting officers as to which officers are interested in being police officers out of a sense of service versus those who want to be police officers out of a sense of adventure, we would eliminate so many problems. And I've never forgotten that, service versus adventure. And what you're describing about Jenkins and his guys are, they're in the adventure group, right? They love that. Tell folks about knockers and jumpers. I don't know if I had ever heard that term till you use it in the book. Nestor, they're knockers and jumpers.
Jump out boys. Yeah. I mean, the police department has relied on that for many, many years. They still are using similar type squads. It goes back to this proactive policing thing. There's officers who respond to 911 calls, and that can be anything, like literally like a cat in a tree, like, you know, identity theft, domestic, you know, situations, you know, the whole gamut. And then there's these officers who are sort of tasked with, you know, being in these high crime areas and seeking out crime. And, Jenkins fit into that group. I just blanked on your question, but what was the question again?
Describe, because the term knockers and jump out boys, you right, read okay. That. I'm so sure that's going to be part of the HBO series, you know, something that's called Knockers and Jump Out Boys, you know.
And they're called that just for that reason. They pull up and jump out of the cars and pat people down and chase them and run through alleys and stuff like that. And knockers is because they often, were known to use aggressive tactics, you know, and beating people up and getting rough with people. And so, you know, the agency's had that for a long time. That's nothing new. And the agency has tried to move away from it. But that kind of policing, I think, you know, there's every officer I talked to talked about how the name of the unit would change, but the people and the tactics would stay the same. Well, and so you see it evolve over time, but it's always the same thing. It exists in some capacity, and it's because they believe they need it.
Justin, they were stopped either by bats. I guess it was bats. I mean, so many commissioners, you needed a scorecard. Right. And we stopped plainclothes, right, according to your book. And then Kevin Davis that reinstituted?
No, Kevin Davis did away with it. He said, I'm ending this. You know, this is over. And it's not going to happen in Baltimore again. And you know, Kevin Davis didn't last long after that.
Right.
His successor reinstated it.
I just Googled Wayne Jenkins, and there's a picture of Kevin Davis giving him like an award and a picture. You know what I mean? All of that stuff sits out there for all of these people that was right under their nose, right?
Nestor, they were winning awards. It's one of the things Justin chronicles so clearly. They were getting emails and
yes,
notes.
The emails are huge, yep.
The emails in your book are amazing. Keep up the great work, Wayne. We need more cops like you, Wayne. And these are coming from Deputy Commissioner Palmieri and Deputy Commissioner D'Souza. This is come and Justin, speak to the fact word got around pretty much, right, that commanders couldn't control Jenkins because he had a direct line to the top in your book. I thought that was fascinating. When he wanted something, flashlights or whatever it was, he had a direct line to the top.
Yeah, and I think that helped, you know. So the big question after the trial was, how deep does this go? Who knew about it? You know, how can this happen? And I was able to do a public records request for his emails, which is not easy to do. I mean, you know, that's a huge challenge in our job. But, you know, they really do reveal the nature, the internal nature of this stuff, and sheds a lot of light. It's not that everybody knew about it. It's not that everybody's in on it. It's not that everybody's doing it. Although some of the officers who cooperated with the FBI do in fact say that you know, this is something that we did in these units. I think there's levels to that. I think, you know, skimming money off the top, cutting corners might be more commonplace than, say, you know, stalking and hunting a huge target and stealing drugs and money. But nonetheless, they say it existed on a wide scale. But as far as like, so what does the rest of the department know? What is the rest of the department viewing this guy as? And you see his group would go out and get guns, you know, 1, 2, 3, 5 a night. And then Jenkins would send out an email to make sure everybody knew about it. He'd say, look, you know, look at all these instances where we did a good job last night. And the praise would flow in. And there's not a lot of follow-up, you know, when these cases would fall apart in court. You know, nobody's sort of circling back to say, well, wait a minute, that gun seizure actually got thrown out. That wasn't a good case. Because it is a very much like, what have you done for me lately? We got to put out today's fires. We got today's crisis. Let's just keep going. And there's not a lot of reflection. You can, and that's, again, a thing that happens in a department that is just always lurching from one thing to the next and having constant turnover, is there's not a lot of, like, looking back. And let's not overlook the fact that Jenkins was a sergeant. The sergeants are the eyes and the ears for the police department. They are the frontline supervisors. They're interacting with their detectives, and they're relied upon to give accurate information up to their supervisors, who then pass it up, you know, six more rungs up the chain. So if the sergeant is lying, and he's doing things he's not supposed to, and his lieutenant, who's got, you know, 3 or 4 other sergeants to pay attention to, isn't aware of it, the information getting filtered up to the top is not good information. And these sergeants are incredibly important. There's 3 sergeants who are in prison or going to prison in this case.
Remarkable. Just remarkable. So Nestor's question is, because we have so much, we have to get to Sean Suter because he's such a tragic part of this. So Nestor's question is, how does it all eventually come crumbling down? And comes what I, the short version for me, and you can make it clear, is we've got a special agent for the FBI, a Jensen, right? She's on the case. She's sniffing it. Then there's this role that this wiretap from Harford County plays, which eventually leads us to the ruse to get all these guys into internal affairs under false pretenses at the end. There's a lot there, but that's the part that Nestor would like you to fill us in on. How does it come crumbling down?
Well, here's how it doesn't come crumbling down: from an internal affairs investigation or a complaint from a victim. And there's various reasons why people either did not make complaints because it was not in their interest, or they did not believe they would be believed, or they had, you know, they were, as you said earlier, they had done things themselves that they had to, you know, they're looking out for their own freedom. And then there's bad internal affairs investigations where they're not properly vetted, or there's no evidence. What it does come down to is there was a DEA group using local task force officers from Baltimore County and Harford County. They were investigating overdoses in their communities where the drugs they determined were coming from a city drug crew in Northeast Baltimore. And they wanted to take down that group and just, you know, try to stop that flow of drugs. And what they end up doing is getting up on a wiretap and hearing conversations where one of the dealers, he's, you know, his childhood friends or same neighborhood friends with one of the Gun Trace Task Force detectives, and they realize, okay, we have a dirty cop here, and you know, at that time it's one, and they want to listen to him and find out what else he's doing and how he's helping this crew, and that leads to the unfurling of all this other stuff. So they fell backwards into it. I mean, there's no other way to put it. There had been complaints to the FBI about these officers. There had been complaints to internal affairs, but it was this drug wiretap that opened up this seam. And Jenkins wasn't in the Gun Trace Task Force at that time. It's important to note. He gets transferred in mid-investigation. You know, he might not have been detected. In fact, there's one amazing detail I was able to uncover, that the FBI, when he was transferred in, because of his good reputation, they said, well, let's bring him into the fold. Let's see if he can help us bring these bad guys down, you know, which would have been a catastrophic mistake. But in the end, you know, yeah, they brought down this group and were able to follow the spider webs out and get other officers in their orbit who were doing some of the same things.
So Justin, they get I'm going to fast forward just because of time. So they get enough evidence, and they're ready to arrest the entire task force. And there's one.
There's actually one guy who did not get arrested, which is an interesting thing in of itself. But go ahead.
No, go ahead. Who didn't get?
There was a guy named John Kluel who worked on the task force, and basically they determined that the officers would send him away when this stuff was going on, or they would keep him at you know, limited information, which again goes to show you the way that it can be conducted without even the people in their own unit necessarily knowing about it.
Well, we remember, I mentioned, what was it, Officer Kolopsis, I guess it was, where they
Kostopoulos,
give him,
yeah.
Kostopoulos, they give him a test, right? Herschel and Jenkins, I guess, take him back and say, you know, how would you feel about doing this? And I mean, the way I take it from your book is he basically says, you guys are freaking nuts. Yeah. And then before long, he's moved out of that task force, right?
Right. It was so important to tell stories of people like Detective Kostopoulos, of Detective Ryan Gwynn, about being in the orbit and sort of, you know, how did it look to you? What did you know? What did you think of them? What do you think now that you do know? And you know, it's really hard to it's a shame that it does cast a shadow on people who worked with these guys over the years, and like, well, how could you not know?
Maybe
some of them did, and you know, they're not telling the truth, and that haze, you know, I wanted to convey that haze, really, because it's difficult to know, but through those stories you find out how complicated the whole picture is.
Well, in any work environment, you're ratting out people on your team. It's always right. I mean, there's some precision that needs to be involved, whether it's an education where Don was, say we got a bad teacher here, you know, this teacher may have a problem or whatever, to everybody having a gun and a badge and very little accountability from a taxpayer, right? From a taxpayer, you think, man, who are you giving these guns and these badges to? And who's holding them accountable? And then once it starts, right? Once they make one heist for $500, it leads to $1,000, it leads to $50,000. Then you go that far in down the criminal path. And I'm sure your television series, and we'll get to that in a minute for sure, let you promote all the incredible things that are going on with that. But that's what's going to make this fascinating television, reading, whatever, because the mind must be, I can't be caught. I can't. Yeah.
So then, Nestor, on the morning, and Justin will fill us in, because there's a piece of the morning that I wondered, why that? So they invite them all under false pretenses. They discuss how we're going to arrest them. They don't want it to be a shootout and what have you. They invite them under false pretenses, in the way I read the book, to internal affairs offices, and they're ready to arrest them. To the point where, and I want you to clarify this part to me, they have the SWAT team positioned, ready to react on the morning they're being arrested. My question for you is, did they fully expect these guys to go all Wyatt Earp and possibly pull guns and have a gunfight at the OK Corral? I'm trying to figure out why the SWAT team was positioned as we're bringing in the Gun Trace Task Force to arrest them.
I think that's just the way they do it, because when you do go into internal affairs, you have to check your gun at the front door. So they weren't armed at the time they were arrested. But yeah, I think that's just the way it goes down.
So then the last piece before we jump to Souter, and it's a puzzlement to me in the book, Nestor. There's an early case that Jenkins is involved in, the Umar Burley case, that ends up in a big financial settlement years later with the Burley family, and I actually was gratified there. I happen to know Judge Dick Bennett pretty well. He's a personal friend, and when I read your book, I texted him and I said, I'm not surprised, Judge. You know, there's this moment you describe where Judge Bennett comes down off the dais, walks over to Burley and says, I'm really sorry. You know,
yeah, it was quite a moment. Yeah.
Oh my God. In the book, I mean, get somebody nice to play Bennett, because he's a good friend to me. So pick a good actor to play him. But it's a wonderful moment, and it captures Dick. But here's what I can't put together, Justin, and I don't know if you've been able to put it together. Even until the end, even when Jenkins pleaded guilty, he kept insisting, except for the Burley case. Why was it so important for him to say, not the Burley case? I wasn't able to make 2 and 2 equal 4 on that.
That is one of the open questions. So that case involved planted drugs. It involved a squad that at the time included Jenkins, Sean Suter, and Ryan Gwynn. They say that they saw what they thought was drug activity. They chased Umar Burley. He fled because he's scared. He gets into a fatal car crash that kills an 87-year-old man, actually a father of a police officer. Drugs were planted in the car. That much is clear. Jenkins pleaded guilty to knowing there was drugs planted in the car. But as you said, he maintains it was not him. And in fact, he told the feds that it was Sean Suter who did it. Suter, you know, Brian Gwynn says he had no indication of that. He saw Suter recover the drugs. He believed, you know, it to be a clean pickup. And I don't know what would have happened if that case went to trial. But that undercuts, you know, Suter was going to be brought in to testify about that, about what he knew. And I was able to report actually recently that they told him, you know, we're hearing that either you did it or you know that someone did it, and we want you to testify to that. And then the day before he's supposed to go into the grand jury, he is shot while on duty and killed. And it's a big, you know, the story shifted from there was a manhunt and a six-figure reward to find the killer. And then some folks in the department started saying, you know, I don't think there is a suspect. I think that he did this to himself and staged it to look like a murder. And it's actually a suicide. And you know, that sounds crazy. I mean, that just the idea that someone might think they could pull that off is an extraordinary kind of thing. And yet, as people sort of explored it some more, it seemed like there was some legs to it. It's still a mystery. It's still ruled a homicide. I think the department, though, you know, internally views it as a suicide, and they're not actively investigating it. And I try to lay out new information. I try to, you know, talk about some things that really haven't either been focused on or known about, and also walk through the process of the review of that case. There was an outside review led by a veteran city and county homicide investigator. And
A legend.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. He's been involved in so many high-profile cases.
Gary Childs is a legend.
Yeah. And so, and now, again, I was gratified with the people that I was able to sit down in this book, and to include Gary Childs, to include Umar Burley, to include Antonio Shropshire, the drug dealer who was being investigated, led to all this, to Maurice Ward, one of the Gun Trace Task Force members themselves. You know, the people who are. There's a kaleidoscope of characters. You get so many different views on this and perspectives, and all together, you know, I wanted to just have this, like, you know, comprehensive view of this story and how all this can happen.
Well, you did that. And before I do have a couple of things that we have to do before you run. I want to get at the very end. I want to talk about the riots and Charles Shelley. I was fascinated by that. But before we do that, I want you to, you alluded to it in segment one. I want to make sure we wrap it in a nice bow here in segment two. Knowing what you know, knowing what you've seen, does the current commissioner have a process in place? And I guess the same goes for the mayor. Do they have operations in place now from where you sit to prevent another Gun Trace Task Force? Are they up to preventing this from happening again?
So that's a tough question. You know, one thing that is key is that body cameras were still coming online during this, when this was going on. Only two of the officers had them, and they weren't properly using them. And they might have gotten in trouble for not properly using them at some point had the indictments not come down. I think body cameras are important. Also, I think we know that people will always find a way, whatever's set up, people will find a way around it. So it's not a complete... it's not a complete cure. You know, there's been recommendations about more integrity stings, where basically they put money on a bench or something, or in a console with a cadet who's undercover, and see if the officers take it. I think there's talk about doing more of those and polygraphs and things like that. But, you know, it's going to come down to, you know, again, that supervision on the ground. And Commissioner Harrison's from New Orleans. He started a program there called EPIC, where it encourages people to stop others from doing things that aren't right, to report it, to feel safe doing that. And they're trying to institute that culture here. And, you know, it remains to be seen.
Well, I want to, again, I want to thank you, folks who haven't bought it. We own this city. Get to your bookstore, get to Amazon, wherever it is. You won't be able to put it down. It is terrific. It's going to be a great miniseries. I know Nestor wants to talk about that before we let you go as well. But Nestor, I've got to draw your attention to an incident at the very end of the book. And I know you know where I'm going, Justin. I'm trying to think. I bet your wife still is angry at you over that. I'm trying to think. I can't imagine telling my wife, you go out in the midst of the riots, Freddie Gray. You were told by the police not to break the perimeter. You say, hell with that. I'm a reporter. I've got to go down a side street. You end up on a side street. And it sounds to me like your life is truly in danger. And a gentleman by the name of Charles Shelley, you didn't know his name. Is that right, Shelley? Do I have the name right?
Uh-huh. Yep,
Charles Shelley comes up and he puts his hand around you in the middle of the road. Just walk our listeners through that, because I'm reading that and I'm going, I don't know if I'm ever telling my wife that if I did it. And I just want to know, Justin, what kind of stones did you have that night to allow you to drive down that street?
No, I was on foot. And I mean, you know, again, I've never felt in danger, despite, you know, the types of things we cover. And, you know, usually when I go to a crime scene, it's full of police. And when I go into the neighborhoods, people are very friendly. And you know, so that in that moment, I'm a reporter. I got to see what's going on. And there's something, you know, crazy going on. I want to be in the middle of it. I don't want to hear about it later or watch it on TV. I got to get in there. So as I walked in, you know, a family was like fleeing the area, and the woman, they hit the brakes, and the woman said, do not go in there. I was like, yeah, come on. And so I walk in, and yeah, it was chaotic. And I'm trying to stay back a little bit. And, you know, this guy throws his arm around me, and it does not feel friendly in that context. You know, it feels like he's going to put me in a headlock or something. But he said, I'm going to protect you. At a certain point, I felt like a baby. I don't need protecting. This is silly. So I told him, hey, listen, I'm going to head out. I'm going to go closer to where everything's going on. I got to get some pictures and things like that. And someone tried to rob me. I got pepper sprayed, and I thankfully was able to turn just in time, and I got it on the back of the head. It burned all night. I ran back to Charles Shelley and he was a member of the Crips gang. They're all wearing blue. He told me that. He walked me out when I had to go back to file my story. So one of the best things about the book, and I'm glad you picked up on that, because it meant a lot to me, was I always wanted to talk to him. Like, why did you help me? You know, what's going through, you know, what have you done since? What's going on with you? Tell me more about your life and what was going on with you at that time. And we reconnected last spring, just as the George Floyd protests were starting, actually. And so, and it allowed me to close the book in a way that We Own This City is an ominous kind of title. It's about the officers being able to do whatever they want. They own the city. It was a quote from Donald Stepp at the trial, that he felt the officers own the city. But allow me to, one of the things that Charles Shelley said to me in our conversation when we met up was, he said, you know, it's the citizens who own the city. You know, we are the ones who, if the police have our respect, you know, we can help them drive down crime. We'll be willing to testify and work with them and things like that. He didn't say that.
We don't want our grandmothers and mothers killed either, right?
Exactly. That's exactly what he said. He said, nobody wants this stuff going on their street. But, you know, if they don't respect us, we don't respect them, and it all falls apart. And so the title actually is sort of a double meaning. Really, that yes, the cops own the city. If that's what they want to do, if they want to run roughshod over people, or they can, you know, it's the citizens who own the city, and you're not going to get there without partnering.
Hey, two things you mentioned. You know, so much came out of Shelley and that night. We could talk for hours, but you did mention another name that we'd be remiss. Donald Stepp Jr. in this thing, the bail bondsman, and his connection to Jenkins, pretending to be police officers on certain nights, right? I mean, I'm interested in Stepp, and also this mysterious call you got tonight that regarding Sean Suter that you said in the book, I think, still haunts you.
Yeah, I mean, Stepp's a real interesting guy. He's a quirky guy, and he and Jenkins at you know, once they got Stepp had pictures and videos. He'd been documenting the things they'd been doing. And Jenkins was getting ready to plead guilty anyway, but Stepp was the final nail in the coffin. But yeah, he would take drugs off the street and drive him out to this guy's house on the water in Middle River. And, you know, during the riots, Stepp said that Jenkins intercepted people coming out of a pharmacy with a bag of pharmaceutical drugs. He didn't even know what it was. And so he just takes it to Stepp and pulls up in the middle of the night and pops his trunk and gives this stuff to him. So, you know, Stepp is, you know, he was, it was interesting too, because you have these officers going from the county into the city to pull people over, search people, get guns and drugs. And then yet, you know, the drugs go back out to the county where they're sold under the, you know, approval of an officer. And it really does go to the way that drug enforcement is carried out differently in different locations based on violence largely. I mean, let's be honest, you know, if there's not people getting shot in Middle River, the police aren't going to feel compelled to be knocking down doors, trying to get these drugs to the same extent as they are and thinking that they can, you know, go after drug dealers to stop gun violence in the city. But nonetheless, it leads to disproportionate enforcement. As far as that call, you know, I cheated a little bit, you know, that call, I don't know that
tell folks about the call, because okay, I'm assuming they know. You're at this press conference and you get this mysterious call.
Yeah, the night that Suter was shot, you know, I'm waiting outside of Shock Trauma to get a briefing from the police. We don't know anything about it. We know that a homicide, I heard, you know, who he was, that it was a homicide detective named Sean Suter who was shot. But we don't know the circumstances. And someone calls me on my cell phone, someone who I'd interacted with years earlier, and says to me, you know, this is not a coincidence. You know, he was going to testify against those dirty cops this week. And I'm thinking, there's no proceedings going on this week. There's no hearings. There's no testimony. There's no trial. What that doesn't make any sense. And lo and behold, it turned out to be true. I cheated a bit though, because I don't know that person necessarily knew what they were talking about, but it sent a chill up my spine in the moment, because it put in my mind that there could be more going on here. And it was cognizant as I tried to search for the truth about whether he was killed or committed suicide, that, like, you know, is that an angle here? Is that something that's possibly true? Ultimately, I don't, just based on the available information, it doesn't seem possible. But it's definitely a thing that people in the city still think about that case. People think that they have all kinds of ideas about what could have happened. And that lends itself to that in a city where there is so much subterfuge and things that are going on that takes years to be revealed. Let me just go back to step real quick, because I think this full circle with what you're talking about the county police. You know, Jenkins brought step to a search warrant at one point, and it's full of county officers. And you know, he's not supposed to be there, but Jenkins is trying to play it off like, you know, we're here, and they're like, okay. But one of the officers at the scene was assigned to investigate step. They believed him to be dealing drugs, and he recognized him at the scene. And all the officers had to write up reports about what they saw, and I was able to get those and just paint that scene. It's one of those, like, you know, unbelievable, true story kind of things. And there's many of them throughout the book.
Now, shout out to all of my friends, the men and women of Baltimore County Police Department. Come off pretty darn well in this book. Nestor, what do you want to know about HBO before we go?
Well, yeah, I was going to say, man, you know, Simon's got the word out on this, and I've been give me a little bit of a backroom dealings on what we're expecting and when a book becomes a show.
I mean, it happened at the same time during the trial. I'm a newspaper reporter. I've not ever seen myself writing a book. But Simon reached out to me at the trial and said, "Yeah, I think this could be a show, and I think you should write a book." And I didn't know the first thing about that, so he kind of helped me to make a connection, and I had to take it from there. It took a long time to get the deal. I thought the story was fantastic. I would never doubt in my ability to do it, but you know, getting people to believe that me, a Metro newspaper reporter, could pull it off, you know, it took some convincing, and ultimately I landed with a great place, Random House. So ever since then, you know, the show's been quietly in the works for a while, the word's out now, and it might be filming. It's going to be filming soon, I think.
Well,
it's a mini
series. Well, as the executive producer, Justin,
I am not an executive producer.
Come on now.
No,
get an executive.
I'm not.
Well,
I'm not.
Tell Simon or whoever's, there's only one guy that can play. I said to my wife after I read the book, I said, this is the easy part of being, only Donnie Wahlberg can play Jenkins. I said, they can cast everybody else. Jenkins is Wahlberg. It's just, you read it, that's all I can see jumping off your pages. So we can't wait. We could do another hour, Nestor, but I know he's got to go to work.
Justin, it's great to have you on, really. I appreciate it, and we appreciate the book and you know, all the great reporting. I mean, I'm sorry our city here provides the backdrop for, you know, this sort of thing. And you did mention the Suter thing. When all that's going on, I'm thinking, well, all this other stuff happened. You know, all of this is surreal to some degree.
Yeah.
But you've done an incredible job. We're looking forward to continuing reading your reporting. We'll talk about the Sun. Anything you want to say about the Sun or the future of the Sun?
Oh boy. I mean, everything's so up in the air right now. We're really everybody who's willing to give support to that, we appreciate it, because it's, you know, I don't want to be too dramatic, but like, you know, you've seen newspapers in other cities like shut down altogether or really be contracted to the point where they're not effective. And we've shrunk a lot and we're trying to get into local ownership hands and hopefully find a model that works. There's a lot of important reporting to be done in this town, in this region. The deal that was struck appears to be on, you know, in jeopardy, but it's not over yet. And, you know, I think we're going to be trying to do some, like a rally or something or something to try to just sort of get the word out there and that we're not giving up. So that's the best I can say there.
We'll be at the rally. And again, I'm going to thank you. You did something that people don't always do. You take a few pages at the end of the book in the acknowledgments and you give it away. You thank all the people who helped you. Other reporters, you know, Luke Broadwater's name was in there. Luke's a good friend of the show, been on a number of times. So you go down the list and say, hey, it wasn't just me. It wasn't just Justin Fenton. All these people really helped. So really great, great work, Justin. And thanks for stopping by.
All right. Yeah. Thanks so much. Appreciate
Justin
the conversation.
Fenton, go check out the book and go check out his work. We own the city. And of course, you can follow him on Twitter for all the latest doings around town. And he'll have a gig as long as we have crime here. So when we eradicate crime, you move to the sports department with me, Justin. All right.
That's right.
We are WNST.net, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. We even tell the tough stories and we never stop talking. Baltimore, positive.